Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have a good friend, a very, very young lady who's built an amazing business. Priyanka Mittal, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Priyanka is a bachelor's from the University of California. She's from Harvard Business School. She is a director of KRBL, which is the world's largest rice millers and exporters of the India Gate and other brands. Priyanka is a member of the YPO, which I am also a member of. She's a member of CII, ASSOCHAM, FICCI, and FIEO. And more importantly, she is an advisor to Women Political Leaders Global Forum. My God, what an amazing achievement at such a young age. Well done.
Thank you.
Priyanka, your family business was founded in 1889 by your great-grandfather. Tell us about the journey of this business over the last 140, 150 years.
So, my great-great-grandfather started the business. They moved from Rajasthan to a place called Lailpur in Pakistan, which is now called Faisalabad. And it was actually a very industrious town. And I'm told, you know, when they moved, it was much like they started the journey as entrepreneurs. And, you know, they had a very successful run, which culminated into banking, mustard seed oil business, cotton, largely, you know, the major agricultural produce of the day. And at that time, you know, banking became the primary business. They got into charitable institutions very early on. So I understand, and I'm told by my grandfather, that they did education institutions, colleges, you know, akin to hospitals.
And this was all pre-partition?
This was all pre-partition.
Okay.
So, they were very big on education. So, you know, we are Marwari family. And, you know, being industrious is part of our DNA.
Correct.
But there was a lot of impetus on educating. So my grandfather was an educated person, and as was my grandmother. And then partition happened, and then we had to start from scratch. So my grandfather was...
So the entire family relocated to Delhi?
That's right. Okay. So we had a very large network of commission agents across India, undivided India. And, you know, the base used to be Delhi for collection. And so because they did not have many assets in India, that was the only property. So they all moved to India. In fact, he was the last. So I must tell you that we were amongst the last family that came in.
Wow.
Because my great-grandfather didn't want to move. He said, this is my home. And we are going to remain. But I think we were very close to Gandhiji as a family, and we ran a lot of his initiatives on educating women, child, etc., etc., that it was actually requested that we actually come over.
Okay. Okay.
So we were amongst the last family. I'm told the last train that actually came to India.
Brought
we came on,
family.
Yeah, brought the family here.
Wonderful.
And my grandmother tells me that, you know, she had a napkin, a handkerchief, pardon me, on her waist. And, you know, that was snatched from her. And she says, well, this is not your property anymore. So, yeah, some really emotional memories. But, yes.
So, tell me, what does KRBL stand for all our listeners?
So, KRBL actually is the name of the two founders, two brothers who started the business, Khushiram and Bihari Lal.
Okay.
So, Khushiramji did not have any children, and he started a dharamshala in Haridwar, which is actually still operated by us and maintained by us.
Wow.
And Bihari Lalji, so we are the fifth generation of the Bihari Lalji family.
Amazing. And you've been involved with the business since 2001.
That's right.
How has your journey been in the world of commodities?
Yeah, so it's actually been very tumultuous, yet very, very gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
I am the only woman in the Indian rice industry space.
I was going to ask you that. Yeah.
And I am one of the two in the world, I'm told. So I would always go out and say that I'm the only one. And I was corrected last year at Harvard Business School that wherein another lady approached me and said, I'm the other one. And she's in Arkansas.
Okay.
So you're one of two that head rice business.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's a male bastion, you know, getting initial buy-ins was very hard. And in all candidness, I think I faced more internal challenges than external challenges. Because, you know, you want to be first accepted as a co-worker, then as a manager, then as a boss, and then as a leader.
Correct.
And when you know you're surrounded by men, you're constantly having to revalidate, you know, your leadership skills and your leadership potential. So yes, but I think externally it was a very gratifying journey, contrary to the prejudices on Middle East and other parts of Asia. Actually, the buy-in was very, very easy and very collaborative. The journey has been very, very gratifying.
Wonderful. So, Priyanka, Basmati is a very, very aspirational product for the masses in India. How has the layman in India, when I say layman, the average consumer, been able to understand and differentiate the different types of basmati rice and the other kinds of rice? Because I someone was mentioning that in rice you can ask for any mix and you'll get that.
That's right. So this industry, while it's a glowing sunshine industry for India, it also has some challenges, and one of the challenges you've outlined. So basmati pre-1990s and post-1990s is a different story. So pre-1990, it was a 100% export product. There was very little market because the product was really expensive. Very few Indian consumers could afford it. And it was actually our chairman, my father's vision to mainstream it, to make it affordable. And in 1990s, the first success story happened with Pusa's hybridization project. And Pusa Basmati 1 was introduced, much to the discernment of the industry. We faced a lot of opposition, and Pusa had to fight its own battle, and KRBL sort of grandfathered and protected that cause and got its due recognition. So it was much like KRBL's journey of finding validation and accreditation. And that actually brought about a revolution in the basmati market. It mainstreamed basmati into the Indian market because it made the product affordable. You know, that was one. And today, I think because of the penetration of Indian brands, because of the education, because of the marketing dollars that are spent on the brand, the understanding on the commodity is fairly evolved. So, you know, consumers now primarily differentiate basmati on account of aging. So, you know, is it a 2 years age? Is it a 1 year age? Is it a non-age? Second is brokens, which is very very widely understood in the market. So whether it's a whole grain, whether it's a tebar, which is three-fourths, whether it's a dobar, which is a two-third. And then there are whole degradation of gradations of brokens when consumers buy basis price point. So not only has it become not just an aspiration, we've made basmati accessible to even the poor man,
that's
you know.
Wonderful.
So that I think has brought about great gains for India.
That's true. Amazing. So, you know, when I was reading about you, I was reading that you're interested in food security and sustainability, hunger and malnutrition, supply chain and food storage. And just before we started talking formally on this interview, you also spoke about politicization of food. Give me your views on some of these topics.
Well, that's really broad. So food security and sustainability, I was introduced very early on to those topics because that is the ethos on which we run KRBL. We, in the mid-1990s, we actually presented to Nigeria its first concept on food security. You know, when this was pre-2008, when food crises actually were understood to be a potential crisis. And, you know, we actually were the first ones to set up a plant. We wanted to replicate...
In Nigeria.
Wow. We wanted to replicate the seed-to-store model that we have. Or I would say, you know, from farming, seed-to-milling and branding model, because Nigeria was largely a rice-importing nation and still continues to be. And we understood the value our business creates on the entire ecosystem. You know, everybody from the farmer down to the consumer, everybody gets impacted. And unless there is collaboration and there is sharing, you cannot systematically profit from this business.
Okay.
So the transactional model, which has been typically the commodity model, is not a sustainable model. And we understood that very early on. In fact, as early as 1970s, 1980s. And we've actually gone about internationally to educate people on our model and apply our knowledge in other countries. So that was one. On malnutrition and hunger, you know, I'm sure it's a worldwide understood fact that one third of malnourished, undernourished children in the world are in India.
Really?
Yes. So the responsibility then is that much greater to address it, because you know, if one third of the world malnourished children are in India. So we actually started working on something called the Hunger Bar, which was basically made out of rice byproducts called bran. And that bar actually met the needs of a meal of a malnourished child. We've not been able to commercialize it, primarily because the goal is to actually give it away free. And right now, you know, there are interesting dynamics in our own industry on top line, bottom line. So that is one project which we hope to mainstream. That is one. Second, we are very active with the Akshay Patra Foundation on the midday meal program. I think that's a brilliant initiative. And we are hoping to deepen our engagement with them. We've started with one kitchen, and the idea is actually over the years and the future to increase that engagement. On storage and warehousing, I think India loses, and depending on which data you read, anywhere from 12 to 14% of grain is wasted because of poor storage. And government has done fantastic amount of work on encouraging industry to build warehousing. E-commerce websites have done, again, great amount
of work.
And
you have a lot of your own warehouses also?
Yes, so 100% of our product is actually stored in our warehouses. We have close to 6 million square foot of warehousing space.
So no more, you know, when I'm much older than you, but when I used to be with ITC, I used to run the entire commodities thing for a few years in Singapore. The nightmare pictures used to be rice and wheat with the Food Corporation of India lying out in the rain and rotting.
That's right.
Has that been changed completely now?
It has largely been mitigated, largely been mitigated by FCI. I wouldn't say it's been addressed completely. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done. There's a lot of impetus now from the government focus on trying to find channel partners who can do a better job. There's a lot of focus now on implementation of technology, on monitoring stocks, movement of stocks. So, you know, a lot, largely stocks get stuck at a point when, you know, onward communication is not there or movement of product is not there. So I think technology has enabled that. So rather than, you know, rotting at a one place, if there's spare warehousing capacity in one depot, then stocks are promptly moved. I think FCI has also systemized its procurement. And I think that's also brought in some efficiencies. Is it 100% addressed? Absolutely not. Is there room to grow and improve? Absolutely. And I think technology and automated solutions become more mainstream, we'll find that greater efficiencies come into the place. But I think, you know, food distribution, I would say procurement and distribution, unless there is a privatization initiative or a public-private partnership, I think 100% realization of the efficiencies would take longer. I'm not saying it wouldn't happen, but it would just take longer. And I think the government is cognizant of that.
So, you know, rice and wheat are two of those staple grains in our country, as I'm sure they are in most other parts of the world. Politics, therefore, has to come into food. What are your views?
So
because this becomes a game every year with every political party.
Right. So my view is that, you know, global politicization of food needs to stop. Because food is a gift of nature, it's a byproduct of nature, and the moment you politicize it, you're playing with nature. And we've all seen what happens when you play with nature, right? So we're anyways in an over-information era where, you know, consumers have access to a lot of information, a lot of channels, whether it's social media and umpteen channels within the social media, print media, online TV, channel, that anything which concerns safety, security, adulteration gets attention. And when, you know, food safety is used as a non-tariff barrier or a restrictive access to its market in the name of protectionism,
mm-hmm.
then I think it's a dangerous territory we are entering. Because anyways, you know, the population is increasing from 8.5 currently, we're projecting to get to 10, and then we say maximum 12 is
mm-hmm.
what Earth can really
manage,
accommodate,
yeah.
right? And in that, where productivity, feeding people is a concern, I think politicizing food is very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So like recently, 2010, India faced its first issue on pesticides issues on rice, where, you know, US, it was mentioned that, because Indian basmati is pesticide laden, it's potentially unsafe, etc., etc. And, you know, that legacy has sort of lingered on.
Mm-hmm.
Indian government has addressed it, but have we done enough to address it? Not really.
Mm-hmm.
And every year, systematically, the number of countries wherein this pesticide issues and, you know, restrictive access to trade in the name of MRLs, which
mm-hmm.
is maximum residue limit,
mm-hmm.
because a certain pesticide becomes orphaned and the pesticide limit is then, you know, overnight changed without looking at really
mm-hmm.
safety, etc. That has created a lot of turbulence. It has created turbulence in the minds of farmers, because the farmers doesn't grow product for the US market or for
yep.
the European market or for the Middle East market.
Correct.
It just grows product, puts all its heart and passion into it, and it wants fair compensation for its product, right? So a lot of effort has been done on creating transparency in pricing, those mechanisms. On top of that, you know, whether a purchaser or a farmer, when he has to deal with additional, it actually brings in a lot of anxiety and frustration.
Mm.
And segregation, you know, India with its complexities,
yep.
we can't really get to segregation. So I think Indian government, because Indian basmati has made a lot of export gains in the last 20 years, we need to really systematically work with at least our major trading nations and find a resolution
Correct.
To this matter. Because today it's rice, tomorrow it can be any other commodity, and potentially, the entire trade flow can get disrupted.
So, you know, you just spoke about the growth of the world population, and I was reading an article or an interview with you where you said that up to 30% of the agricultural production will be reduced by 2080. Is this happening because of climate change? And will the world have the capability to feed all its people?
Right. So two things. Of course, climate change had some effect, but I would say that India today is the leading country on rice research.
Okay.
And in terms of gene pool collection, in terms of gains on productivity, working on varieties, using non-GMO route to address those gains. So for example, Pusa Institute has done phenomenal work on reducing duration, in increasing strength of the stock, so lodging doesn't happen. Delivering certain immunity, so blast is a very common fungicide
mm-hmm.
issue in,
mm-hmm.
in rice, addressing that. Late flowering, so now our winters are not as pronounced in the north as they used to be,
mm-hmm.
right? And the grains require a certain amount of cooling. So how do you address that? So the scientists have done a lot of work naturally to address climate changes. I think the other issue, I said it in the context of vegetarianism, I think animal feed
mm-hmm.
and the amount of food that is grown for animal feed and meat, I think is one widely written cause
Correct.
on food shortage. And I think one very natural way to address is being a vegetarian,
mm-hmm.
which is very endemic, intrinsic, I would say, not endemic, intrinsic
Correct.
To the Indian
Correct.
Diet and
yeah.
the Indian way of living.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, mm. that comment was made.
So I've got one more question
sure.
on KBRL and rice before I move to the next segment. And that is, you know, you said you're a brands person. And again, you've said that customers align with brands. You've got India Gate brand and you've got a whole lot of other brands. What is your philosophy of branding basmati rice and aligning it with customer needs?
So I think brands are individuals, they are human beings.
Correct.
They have emotions, moods, personalities, personas, and they're like children,
yeah.
you know. So when they're adolescent, the needs are different. When they're teenagers, their needs are different. And when they're an adult, the needs are different.
Well said.
So with India Gate, you know, our journey has been very, very educative. I'll tell you the mandate with which India Gate was formed. It was actually to put the best of India to the world, to
Okay.
present the best of India to the world, because India Gate was christened when the make in India was not fancy, and people
Right.
would write make in India in a 0.6 font on the back of the pack,
True.
right? And we wanted to put it on the face of the pack to make it front and center. And it was because, you know, in commodity trading, Ashutosh, you'd
Yeah.
probably agree, there's not a lot of respect on part of Indian suppliers, you know. And so this was really a fight for dignity and respect, you know, that we are Indian, we are. So that was one. Second was to build a respectable global Indian brand. The aspiration was to be global from the very beginning. And so we started with that. With regard to branding, I think the premise has been transparency and ethics.
Okay.
So the trust that we earned was very early. And I'll tell you, you know, there was something called Sharbati very early on when we got into branding, which was called Basmati. And we had a brand called Aarti. So it was not India Gate, it was a brand called Aarti. And when we got into the branding space in India, we decided, we said, we will not call it Basmati because it's not Basmati, you know, and we'll call it premium rice. And our head of sales at that point in time came to us and said, you know, you won't be able to sell anything. And the decision was taken by my father was that, you know what, then I'll just take my chances, but we will never, ever call it something which is not. And so we think that, you know, that trust, I think, is a very important component.
Correct.
And you can lose it very quickly. So like there are brands like India Gate Classic, which are 2 years old, where if the product, if we run out of product, we just simply stop selling, you know. And in a business like ours, where blending is very, very rampant, you could easily blend
Right.
and still service the market.
Sure.
And so then the idea is, no, be honest, be transparent. That has been the other mandate. Third has been, we have been very receptive,
Yeah.
you know, and brand has evolved as consumers have evolved. Our communication has evolved. Our packaging has evolved. But the ethos of delivering more, consistently more than what you pay for it, has been the third pillar, I would say, in branding. Because it's whether you're servicing the premium end or you're servicing the value end, I think the value aspect is very critical. So long as you're delivering more than what you're charging, you'll always be in business.
I agree.
So that has been
the very, very, very wise words indeed for branding. And you know, I love branding myself, and you know, everything you say resonates with me.
Thank you.
So let's move, Priyanka, to the next part, and that is about you personally. You know, you play a very prominent role in various organizations. What fascinated me the most was your association with the Women Political Leaders Global Forum. Talk to me a little bit about what this forum does and the role that you play.
So this forum was started by an MP from Germany, Silvana Koch-Marin, and she continues to lead it. So it was a European, it is a European Parliament initiative, and the mandate is actually to increase women parliamentarians in politics. And actually, it's a women leadership cause, and that's how I got associated to it, because women leaders across sectors, whether it's the public sector, the private sector, the government, or the civil society, play a fascinating role and a very motivating and an empowering role in the government, or in all aspects, I would say, not just in the government. Now, India has been a front runner on encouraging women in politics,
Correct.
Right? Started off very early. But in the other parts of the world, it's not so. So I would say my engagement and through my interactions, what I've learned is India, Asia, and Africa are actually much ahead on encouraging women to be political leaders than the West.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we've had, you know, one women prime minister, whereas the US is yet to have a women president,
yeah.
right? So it was that. Second was, as women leaders, whether we're in politics or in business or in civil society, how can you collaborate to create consistent value?
Correct.
You know, that is the other mandate. Because if politicians act alone, and if the corporate sector acts alone, and the civil society acts alone, there's not a lot of value that's created. So together, what synergies can you create? And third is addressing real issues. Because you know, when there are too many men in the room, there's a lot of testosterone.
I agree.
And with women, the conversation is around families, around children, around food, around, you know, education, etc. So the idea is to have real
I agree.
conversations and possibly look at solutions.
In fact, my personal belief has always been that, you know, and I worked with a lot of ladies in the companies that I owned and where I worked. I think women are much, much more ethical in work and much more hardworking. And contrary to popular belief, women gossip less than men.
I would agree to that. I would
I
agree to that wholeheartedly. So, you know, I spoke at the European Parliament, and I still remember saying that, you know, it was something that everybody had a good laugh. That, you know, when women get a raise, the first thing that they would do is buy something for the house, right? They'd get a gift for the children, something for the house. We've seen a lot of gains in our industry with women participation. In fact, we were amongst the first in our industry to have women on the shop floor. And Ashutosh, I can tell you, I mean, the immediate gains that I saw was
Amazing.
tremendous. Our productivity went up almost 5.5%. Wastages went down, you know, 1.5%. And the sheer volume of product that we do, I mean, those percentages create a lot of financial value at
I
the end of the
agree.
day.
I agree.
So overall motivation is high. Men used to, you know, small things on the plant side, men would have pan masala and all of that. And, you know, with women around, women would actually call them out, say, you know what, you can't
Stop
do
this.
that as per
Correct.
HACCP standards. You got to stop or you won't be allowed to enter. So we've seen a lot of
I agree.
discipline being initiated.
I agree.
So yeah, that is one
Wonderful.
initiative which is very close to my heart, is gender parity.
Wonderful. I agree with you.
Yeah.
You know, you had an amazing run, very successful, part of a big family, of course, but leading a commodities business, and you said one of two ladies at the helm of affairs in rice. What would be three adjectives that define you as an individual?
So I would say first is perseverant.
Okay.
This industry requires a lot of tenacity and persistence. And I think you acquire that just being in the industry for a very long time.
Correct.
That is one. The second I would say is focus, because there are too many factors that can distract you. And so long as you remain focused on the goal, whether the times are good or bad, determines success. And when your decisions have an impact on thousands and thousands directly and indirectly, you need to ensure that you don't lose focus, either
Correct.
in good times or in bad times.
Absolutely.
And the third, I think that defines me, is my belief in, I call it now consciousness, not even God, in consciousness, that,
Okay.
you know, we are simply playing a part in this entire cosmos, that this is a journey. And so long as we deliver a net positive from the time we start to the time we end, that we've played a part. So whether it's, you know, running a rice company or being at home, you know, executing your roles, I think playing the part is, and being part, having that realization that you're part of the cosmos, that consciousness is very important. So
Amazing.
those three define me, I would
Amazing.
say.
That's very well said. Priyanka, thank you very much.
Thank
This
you.
has been an absolutely incredible chat with you. I wish you lots and lots of success in rice and in everything else that you do.
Thank you for
Thank you
having
very
me.
much. Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.